Your time's running.
May it please the court. My name is Jared Navar here for the appellants. Good morning, Your Honors. Texas cannot justify a waiting period on political speech. Section 25.
Why don't we start with mootness? Why is this case not moot?
It's not moot.
I know you're relying on the capable of repetition yet evading review in part. We can just call that the repetition to save about 6 minutes during this argument. But how does this satisfy that exception when you've got to be the same party that might suffer this continuous evasive activity?
Well, because in fact, in cases such as this, in the First Amendment election context, the Supreme Court has multiple times ever since Storer versus Brown in 1972 held specifically that even that second requirement of the capable of repetition exception to mootness is not necessary to be applied in these cases. Storer versus Brown said that directly. A case called Dunn versus Bloomstein, I believe also from the 70s, dealt with it was a Tennessee requirement that was a durational residency requirement and for voting. In other words, a person couldn't vote or unless they met some residency requirement in the state of Tennessee. That can only be applied to a single person one time, just like this statute here. And so the Supreme Court said that because these statutes can be applied against other parties in the future, it's a First Amendment case, they have expressly declined to apply that requirement. Justice Scalia observed that in a dissent in a recent case. There are two Fifth Circuit cases, Carmouche and the other one is cited in my brief, that specifically address the argument that the government has made in their brief as to mootness, as to that specific ground of that exception, Your Honor, and they found that they don't apply. The answer is the Supreme Court and this court simply do not require that prong to be met.
Not sure it's as clear-cut as you're making it out to be. If it's that clear-cut, why did you rely on another basis for saying it's not moot?
Why did I not rely on?
Why did you rely on another basis? Didn't you have another basis for claiming it's not moot?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I mean, there's.
All right.
First of all, the statute is there. There's for the state to argue that you can't come in, that it's moot because they can apply a 2-month waiting period on fundamental political activity, and because you can't litigate it in that 2-month period, all of a sudden you're not subject to the restraint anymore. The state simply can't stop people from speaking for 2 months and say it's too fast to litigate, and now you're not subject to the waiting period.
You should have made that argument more than 60 days out or maybe 6 months out from the election. Are you saying that suddenly a committee just might wake up one morning and think we want to combat this evil that's going on in the state of Texas and let's form a committee and get cracking?
Absolutely. That's the way that political speech works, Your Honor. And the Supreme Court said that specifically in Citizens United. The Citizens United opinion says directly that groups don't know when they may need to speak. People don't pay attention to campaigns until right before the election period. This is the basis for many, many Supreme Court opinions. It's the basis for the Watchtower Bible opinion, which struck down the prior restraint on registration requirement, saying that one of the grounds specifically cited by the court was that it prevents a person from engaging in spontaneous political speech. The plurality opinion in Wisconsin Right to Life in 2007 said specifically that a group like WRTL, which was an already established nonprofit, the Supreme Court specifically said they can't be expected to know when some future blackout period might apply because they don't know when they're going to want to engage in certain speech. And that was an already established group that the Supreme Court used that reasoning to maintain their standing. Here, the way the statutes apply in Texas, the political committee definition applies. It's not a choice. It applies to a group that organically comes together, and if more than one person decides to pool resources and act together for political purposes, they are a political committee.
So you can wait till the day before the election and then pump about $5 million into it with no reporting requirement until after the election?
Absolutely not, because Texas already has report. That's the thing that I really wanted to point out about the state's brief. The real deficiency they have is they cannot state a scenario in which a general purpose committee forms in Texas and is able to avoid last minute filing requirements. It does not matter how late before an election you form. They're called the special pre-election reports. They're discussed in the brief. It's very clear, even in the last 9 days before an election, there's a 24-hour reporting period that applies to any contributions of any size. I think the threshold is maybe $5,000 in terms of if they spend more than $5,000 with respect to one candidate, they have to file a report with the Ethics Commission electronically, which must be immediately posted on the Ethics Commission's website that discloses where the money came from and what they're spending it on. So there is no way for a general purpose committee to avoid that type of requirement. What's interesting is that the type of committee that can avoid that last minute requirement is a specific purpose committee, which the state is arguing we should have just spoken as specific purpose committees. That's wrong for any number of reasons. It's illegal under the definitions, number one, but it doesn't make any sense. It wouldn't further their disclosure interest of the state of Texas, because specific purpose committees file with local filing authorities, and unless a city has required those special pre-election reports in the last 9 days before an election, specific purpose committees don't have to file them. So the scenario you're discussing could never apply to a general purpose committee. That's very clear. It can apply, however, to a specific purpose committee that's set up for a specific municipal candidate. If a specific purpose committee wanted to set up in the last 6 days before the mayoral election in Houston, for example, or in Dallas, there are no last-minute reporting requirements as there are in the election code, and so you could set up the, you know, Houston Citizens for Mayor Parker's re-election 9 days before an election, collect as much money as you want, and spend it without having to file any reports until long after the election. As I said, Texas simply cannot justify a waiting period on political speech, and it's important to look at the entire spectrum of speech that's restricted by this prior restraint. Section 253.037A prohibits independent expenditures. It prohibits a general purpose committee from spending more than $500 in the aggregate. That applies to independent expenditures, and it applies to all types of contributions, whether it be to a candidate or another political committee. So just to tick through those categories of speech, because they're dealt with under different principles in campaign finance law. Independent expenditures do not corrupt as a matter of law. That's very clear. It's been clear from Buckley all the way through Citizens United. The only exception was for corporate independent expenditures, which was overruled in Citizens United. They present no corruption threat as a matter of law, and therefore the state of Texas has no cognizable interest to impose a two-month waiting period on a general purpose committee's independent speech. Contributions with respect to ballot measures do not involve candidate elections. The Supreme Court held in Bilotti in 1978, ballot measure elections do not present a threat of quid pro quo corruption, and therefore Texas has no interest whatsoever in restricting ballot measure contributions from a general purpose committee. Now, all that's left under the statute are contributions that the committee might want to make to a candidate directly or to other political committees. McCutcheon, which the Supreme Court released a few weeks ago, specifically held, the basis of the McCutcheon opinion was that they drew a fundamental distinction between contributions, between limits on base contributions, which are limiting what a person can give to a particular recipient, versus aggregate limits that limit the contributor's overall contributions in the election period. The $500 limit in Section 253.037A is an aggregate limit. It applies without respect to how many individuals the committee wants to contribute money to. And the Supreme Court said, the Supreme Court's words, not mine, were that the aggregate limit at issue in that case does little, if anything, to address the threat of quid pro quo corruption. That rationale applies exactly here. Texas could impose base contribution limits on what a general purpose committee could give to other particular recipients, but they simply cannot use a meat cleaver and impose an aggregate limit because it lacks a cognizable government interest. I want to specifically address the state spent a lot of time and space in its brief trying to strenuously to make this analogy between general purpose committees in Texas and federal multi-candidate committees. And that analogy just does not wash. under federal law, well, let's just illustrate it with reference to these plaintiffs. If these groups had wanted to form right before an election and focus on federal races instead of state and local races, federal law applies, they could have taken in $1 million on day one. On day two, they could have made a $2,600 base contribution to every candidate running for every federal office in the country. On day three, they could have spent the rest of the money in their account on independent expenditures, and 7 days later, they could file their registration form with the FEC. Now, that the only thing that multi-candidate committee status is relevant to is achieving a higher base contribution limit. So instead of being able to contribute $2,600 to other recipients, a federal multi-candidate committee, once it passes those thresholds, it can give $5,000. But it's very clear, there's no dispute in the record on this, the state has not tried to make the argument that there's some sort of prior restraint that stops a federal committee. It's not at all analogous to the situation here with this statute. So how did the district court reach the conclusion that it did, that this statute was consistent with the First Amendment? It only did so by calling the statute a disclosure requirement, and that is fundamental error under every case from Buckley all the way through Citizens United. Every case draws a distinction between hard limits on campaign finances and statutes that require the disclosure of information to the public. In fact, Buckley's discussion of the disclosure requirements that it upheld makes very clear that the Buckley court would not have sustained this kind of a limit. In fact, Buckley specifically distinguishes, in upholding the disclosure requirements under the federal law, Buckley expressly distinguished them from the prior restraints in Thomas v. Collins, which is the case I led with in the briefing, analogizing this Texas statute to a prior restraint. Buckley literally cited Thomas v. Collins for the purpose of distinguishing the federal law disclosure requirements from that type of pre-registration requirement. In federal law, it's only after you exceed a threshold that you have to file a report with the Federal Election Commission. 10 days after you exceed $1,000 in contributions or expenditures, and that threshold is $1,000, that means you could spend $1 million right out of the box with any number of people pooling their resources into a bank account, and only 10 days later do you have to file with the FEC. And that's the way that it should be, so it's not a prior restraint on people's political speech. And what Buckley actually said about the disclosure provisions, and the language is important because it points out how Texas has taken a meat cleaver where they need to use a scalpel. Discussing the disclosure provisions, Buckley said they must be, quote, narrowly limited to those situations where the information sought has a substantial connection with the governmental interests sought to be advanced. Chapter 254 in the Election Code requires all manner of information at all different times in pre-election reports. 253037 doesn't require anything to be disclosed. It's simply a hard limit on campaign finances. And just to illustrate how far the statute...
You're going to bother talking about corporate contributions? You've got about a minute left.
Yes, Your Honor. The second part of this case involves the corporate contribution limit. There's nothing magic about having a separate account. The requirement of the First Amendment is that the state, can't categorically ban a campaign finance activity. It has to use a narrowly tailored means of addressing the state's legitimate interests. Here, the proposal is not to give money to the recipient committee. The proposal is to lend an email contact list. The recipient would only use that to distribute independent expenditure communications not coordinated with a campaign. So there's no legitimate interest to prevent the lending of that list to the committee. And the state can't simply ban a non-monetary contribution. It's not fungible. It can't make its way to a candidate's campaign.
So but how can the state be sure it's only going to be used for independent expenditures?
Just as they are with when a hybrid committee has separate accounts under federal law, there's always a danger that money could be transferred illegally. The state can enforce against that committee, but the state can't simply say, throw up that danger and say, you can't have a separate account for your independent expenditure activity. And that's essentially what they're doing here. My time is up if there are any
save some time for rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Oldham.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Andrew Oldham on behalf of the TC Appellees. Starting with jurisdiction, as we must, it is common ground that the case is moot. The dispute is whether, as Judge Barksdale put it, the repetition doctrine or the repetition exception to the mootness doctrine applies here, and we argue that it does not for three different reasons. First, it's undisputed that this case would be moot under Supreme Court precedent. Notwithstanding what my friend in opposition said earlier this morning, the Supreme Court, in an unbroken line of cases, starting at least in 1979 in the Socialist Worker Party's case and going across election law cases and non-election law cases alike, has said that Article III jurisdiction requires the same party requirement. There is no specific election law exception that applies that somehow Article III applies with certain exceptions in election law cases and not in non-election law cases. So there's no dispute under Supreme Court precedent that the same party requirement applies. Second, this court's cases are not to the contrary. It is true that in two decisions, Moore and Kucinich, both from 2009, this court purported to relax the same party requirement for election law cases, seeming to create basically a different Article III rule if the case implies election law disputes, and then a separate Article III rule that applies in literally every case that walks through the federal courthouse doors. It's the position of the state of Texas that both Moore and Kucinich are wrong, and in the appropriate case, we would urge the court en banc to overturn them, but that's not necessary here, because in every case from the Supreme Court and in Moore and Kucinich, the Supreme Court and this court has said that in order to avail yourself of the repetition exception to the mootness requirement, or sorry, the mootness doctrine, there must be at least a theoretical possibility of repetition. So to illustrate, in Moore, it was at least theoretically possible that Mr. Moore would miss another election deadline. And Kucinich, it was at least theoretically possible that Mr. Kucinich would run for president again and face the TDP's oath requirement. And the same thing in Storer. It was at least possible that Mr. Storer would want to switch parties again and would have to comply with the state with the disaffiliation requirement. And in this case, there is absolutely no possibility that the appoint and show provision in Section 253.037A of the Texas Election Code could ever again apply to these particular committees. In fact, this court's 2012 decision in Wilson versus Bernberg specifically distinguishes Moore and it distinguishes Kucinich, and it says the following at page, I want to make sure I get the page correct. This is 253 of the Wilson versus Bernberg opinion. We agree that not every election case fits within the four corners of the capable of repetition but evading review exception. And the court then goes on to hold that notwithstanding the fact that Wilson versus Bernberg is an election law dispute, it is nonetheless moot. And the reason is because the probability in Wilson versus Bernberg of recurrence between those particular parties, Wilson, who was running for office, and Bernberg, who was a state election official, was so low because the claim was inherently personal between the two of them that it was unlikely to recur between those two same parties. So the state submits to the court today that in order to find that this case is not moot, and to proceed to adjudicate the facial constitutionality of a state election statute, you would have to overturn Wilson versus Bernberg and hold that this case is nonetheless capable of repetition for no other reason than the fact that it's an election law case. And then it would have to say that we are going to apply a specific election law exception to the repetition doctrine. And we would submit that that's inconsistent with Supreme Court precedent. It's inconsistent with even Moore and Kucinich. It's definitely inconsistent with Wilson versus Bernberg. And it runs in the face of basically the entire reason that we have Article III jurisdictional requirements. The whole point of Article III and of the limited jurisdiction of federal courts is to ensure that the plaintiffs that come before you have rights and injuries that are redressable by a favorable decision from this tribunal. And these plaintiffs concede that they do not, that there is nothing that this court could ever do that will fix their particular injuries that they've alleged under the point and show provision. And for that reason, the only thing I should say that they want is the facial invalidation of a statute that applies to third parties that are not before this court and that may never be before this court. And we submit that that is both inconsistent with the mootness doctrine and Article III more generally. So for that basis, we would urge the court to dismiss.
To dismiss the point, appoint and show, but we still have corporate contributions. You're not claiming that's moot.
That's correct, Judge Barksdale. The corporate contribution provision is not moot because TLC is a corporation and SOFA is a corporation. And at least as to TLC, they have submitted at least an allegation, it's not clear how supported it is by the record, but at least an allegation that they would like to give money to candidates. And under controlling Supreme Court precedent, they do not have a First Amendment right to do so. The controlling case on that regard is Beaumont. And the Supreme Court in the Beaumont decision at pages 154 and 155 give three reasons why the state interest in preventing corporate contributions to candidates pass First Amendment muster. We don't take the plaintiff's argument to be a serious challenge to that. Obviously, they recognize that this court is bound by Beaumont. If this court nonetheless disagrees with us on the mootness exception, or the repetition exception to the mootness doctrine, what the court is left with, again, putting aside the corporate contribution piece of this case, is a facial challenge to the appoint and show provision, again, section 253.037A of the Texas Election Code. And the plaintiff's facial challenge in that regard fails because they have a First Amendment right to speak, but they do not have a First Amendment right to speak through a particular committee. And it bears emphasis just how heavy this burden is because they have chosen to bring three separate facial challenges to the Texas Election Code. As the McConnell Court put it at page 207 of the Supreme Court's opinion in that case, it is a particularly heavy burden. And the reason is they first have to identify a particular burden on a particular class of speakers. And again, it's not going to be sufficient to just talk about the plaintiffs in this case because they've styled it as a facial challenge. So we have to look at everyone who's regulated by the statute. They then have to show that that burden is substantial, both in absolute terms, that is, that it's an absolute burden on the class of people that are regulated by the provision, and that it's substantial in relative terms, that is, relative to the plainly legitimate sweep of the statute. And in this case, the district court found at page 941 of the record that there is no evidence that the general purpose committee requirements in the appoint and show provision impose any burden on these plaintiffs, much less are those burdens substantial, and much less are they substantial in relation to the plainly legitimate sweep of the statute. And to the contrary, the decades of experience that the state of Texas and all of the myriad committees that have been formed under this provision show that it does have a plainly legitimate sweep. It was enacted to fix a loophole that allowed the last-minute spontaneous creation of, as what the district court calls, page 944 of the record, inherently opaque general purpose committees that are served for no other reason to either aid corruption, as in the Sharptown scandal, or to avoid reporting requirements until after the election and after political accountability can be meted out at the ballot box. Now, in analyzing the burdens, the part that what the plaintiffs have to show on this summary judgment record in order to survive summary judgment, it is crucial to keep the separate categories of speakers separate, right? Because there are two different categories of speakers. There are corporations, that's TLC and SAFA, and then there are three political committees, TLC-IPA, FOSAFA, and Texas Freedom. And the statute applies to them differently in slightly different ways, and I think it's important to not just say, well, groups are bound or groups are burdened or groups are silenced, because these are different groups of people and the statute applies to them differently. So if we walk through the two different categories of speaker, I think it becomes very clear why the district court was right, that there is not one piece of evidence anywhere in this record that suggests that there was one burden imposed on anyone. So starting with the corporations, TLC and SAFA are the two nonprofit corporations. One is a 501c3, the other one is a 501c4. And the appoint and show provision imposes no burden whatsoever on either of the two of them. The day after they form a general purpose committee, they are free to spend an unlimited sums of money on direct expenditures, which is, direct expenditures is what Texas calls an uncoordinated or independent expenditure. They're the same thing. But the day after they form the committees, those two corporations, after Citizens United, can speak to their heart's content through direct expenditures. If they want to instead form committees, they can form committees. They can form what's called a specific purpose committee. And the only difference is that when they form a specific purpose committee, they have to disclose upfront what they want to talk about. So they can say, we support or oppose this candidate, or we support or oppose this ballot measure. But that's the only distinction. And if they do the specific purpose committee, they can begin speaking immediately as to whatever it is that they care to talk about. They just have to disclose up front what it is that they intend to talk about. The point of TLC and SAFA's First Amendment challenge to the way that the statute works appears to be that the First Amendment somehow allows them to choose not to speak directly. That is, not to say up front, we are TLC and this is our message, or we are SAFA and this is our message, but instead that they have a First Amendment right to hide behind a proxy, as the district court puts it again at page 944 of the record, an inherently opaque proxy. And no court at any level of any jurisdiction has ever held that. To the contrary, the Buckley D.C. Circuit decision, which the district court cites, which and again was affirmed by the Supreme Court in Buckley versus Vallejo, as well as then-Circuit Judge Kennedy's opinion in CalMed, which was affirmed by the Supreme Court in CalMed, both suggest the opposite. They both suggest that when you try to, that you do not have a First Amendment right to choose indirect speech when you have a perfectly viable alternative to speak directly. So I think as to the corporations, it's very clear that the statute has no implication on, no application to them and imposes no burdens on them. And perhaps for that reason alone, it would be sufficient to reject their facial challenge, since the whole point of this is that there's some substantial overbreath to the way the statute works. Turning to the committees, there are three of them. There's TLC-IPA, there's FOSAFA, and then there's Texas Freedom. And again, there's no burden on them, and that's for at least three different reasons. First, as soon as they form, or at any point after they form, as the district court points out, the 60-day requirement for the organizational requirement for these general purpose committees is not tied to the election day, right? So they have unilateral control over when they want to form. They could form 6 months before the election or 6 years before the election or, you know, without any particular election in mind. But whenever they form, there's a particular provision in the Texas Election Code, and I would like to emphasize it for the court. It's 254.162, and that allows those general purpose committees to switch to specific purpose committees by just filing a piece of paper with the Texas Elections Commission to say, this is what we'd like to do. So I think Judge Barksdale at the beginning of the argument asked the hypothetical about, well, what if they spontaneously decide that there's this urgent issue that they have to talk about? These three general purpose committees that are before you today, like every general purpose committee in the state of Texas today, has the right to change. They just file a piece of paper and say, hey, we don't feel like complying with the 60-day requirement, or we don't want to comply with the 10-contributor requirement. Instead, we want to speak today, and here's the issue that we care about today, and they can do that. So to call it a prior restraint is really quite an extraordinary overreach and use of hyperbole, I believe. The only argument I think that they have, or what I understand them to be arguing, is that they want to somehow avoid those upfront disclosures associated with the specific purpose committee. That is, they don't want to send in a piece of paper and say, this is the candidate we support. But they don't have a First Amendment right to do that. I mean, on a much harder set of facts, this court's sister circuit, the D.C. Circuit, sitting en banc in a case called Speech Now, said on even as to independent expenditure-only committees, that is, committees that have, unlike these plaintiffs, no desire to give potentially corrupting donations to candidates, even if your only purpose is to form a independent expenditure-only committee, you still have to organize as a PAC, and you still have to comply with the PAC disclosure obligations. That there's no First Amendment right to sort of hide behind anonymity in that sense. And so I think that, you know, and as I should also say, as the district court again emphasized, because these are inherently opaque organizations, the state's interest in requiring disclosure of a general purpose committee's activities is paramount. If they instead choose to forego speaking directly, and if they choose instead to forego organizing as a specific purpose committee, and they choose instead to stay as they originally organized, which is a general purpose committee, the plaintiffs cannot then claim that they've somehow been silenced or burdened. And I think an analogy may be quite helpful in thinking about this. In a Supreme Court decision called Walter versus LeGrand from 1997, Mr. LeGrand was sentenced to death by the state of Utah, and he had a choice in his execution method. He could either choose lethal gas or lethal injection. And Mr. LeGrand chose lethal gas and then brought an Eighth Amendment challenge to the cruel and unusual nature of the lethal gas. And the Supreme Court said, no, you're not allowed to choose one option over another and then premise your constitutional challenge on the fact that the thing you chose is different than the one you forewent. And it's exactly the same sort of thing here. They have an option to speak directly. They have an option to speak immediately, even as a committee if they want to form a specific purpose committee. They don't have a right to intentionally forego those options, choose a general purpose committee, and then fault the general purpose committee for not resembling the things that they forewent. Even if the general purpose committee could be a burden, as the district court found at page 941, quote, there is no evidence in this record that compliance with these requirements are particularly onerous, expensive, or time-consuming. And again, when they have chosen to style their challenge to appoint and show exclusively in facial terms, exclusively in facial terms, they have a really high burden, right? They have to show both that it's unconstitutional as to them to satisfy what the district court said at 941 of the record, but they also have an obligation to come forward with expert reports and analyses that would show you that there is substantial overbreadth. That is, how many committees are being formed in the 60 days in the run-up to the election? How many committees are being inhibited in their ability to switch between them? How many different pieces of speech and varieties of speech have somehow been foregone by the fact that Texas has these organizational requirements for its committees? And this record has none of that. All of the things that you would see in cases like McConnell and Citizens United and even McCutcheon in terms of the rigor that it takes to bring a facial challenge like this are completely bare in this case. And I think the reason is because anyone who sat down and tried to analyze what kinds of burdens are being associated with these organizational requirements would have to admit that since you can speak directly, the burdens are minimal or zero. Finally, there, for the first time in the reply brief in this case, and for that reason perhaps this argument is waived and the court doesn't even care about it, but to the extent that the court noticed in the reply brief for the first time the suggestion that somehow the specific purpose committee is an inferior substitute to the general purpose committee, that argument fails both factually and legally. The argument seems to be something about, well, we want to be a long-standing, a super efficient, big general purpose committee. We don't want to have our purposes limited by being a specific purpose committee. So as I say, factually, the most relevant document in the record is at page 778. And in at page 778 of the record, you will see a document where TLC-IPA submits to the federal district court an affidavit from their treasurer, and they identify the candidates that they intend to support by name. And they identify the races for the candidates they haven't yet identified. But they identify the races by name. And if instead of filing this document in the Western District of Texas, I'm sorry, the United States District Court for the Western District of Texas, if they instead filed it with the Texas Ethics Commission, they would have satisfied the specific purpose committee requirements. And there would be, we would not be standing before you today.
Filed under seal in the district court?
No, ma'am. It's filed openly. It says these are the people that we intend to support. Now, I don't know if perhaps the plaintiffs in this case are operating under the misapprehension that a specific purpose committee can only support or oppose one candidate. But if that's what their concern is, then they wanted to support multiple candidates. If that's the concern, that's false. And in fact, I have, and I'm happy to submit for the court's convenience if it's relevant, records of specific purpose committees, that is, people who identify up front the candidates or measures that they intend to support or oppose, records of specific purpose committees that have multiple candidates. For example, in Bexar County, which is where these plaintiffs are, Bexar County, Texas, there is a specific purpose committee called the Judicial Roundup PAC that identifies four different candidates for judicial office that they intend to support or oppose. So it's just not true as a factual matter that the specific purpose committee is somehow inferior. And as a legal matter, it's also not relevant for First Amendment purposes. And I would point the court's attention to Colorado Republican II, the 2001 decision from the Supreme Court cited throughout the briefs, where the Supreme Court majority points out the fact the very point that one committee could be bigger or more efficient or better able to pool resources may mean that it has a greater First Amendment force, but there is a countervailing interest on the state side that, and as the court puts it, it cuts both ways, because the countervailing interest on the state side is the bigger and the more opaque and the more flexible and the more efficient you are, the more important disclosure becomes, because it's important to make sure that all of those resources are being channeled for true First Amendment activity and not corrupting activity. So I think that all of the various ways that the particular committees in this case could try to challenge as First Amendment, that is, whether they don't like being specific purpose committees or they don't like the burdens of the general purpose committees, are either unsupported by the record, legally irrelevant, or both. And finally, I would just like to emphasize just how upside down the First Amendment argument in this case seems to be. Because the plaintiffs, by arguing effectively that this sort of speech by proxy is protected by the First Amendment when direct speech has been foregone, have cited the very cases that undermine the position. So for cases like MCFL, Wisconsin Right to Life II, and McConnell, in the federal system, the Supreme Court has said PACs are sometimes not substitutes for direct impingements on speech. So as you know, in the federal system, especially prior to Citizens United, there were a series of burdens that were imposed on people speaking directly, in particular corporations. And the Supreme Court often had to deal with the question as to whether the federal government could ban direct speech but offer indirect speech as a substitute. And the answer to that case differs by case, but sometimes the answer is no. Texas law does the exact opposite. If you want to speak directly, you can speak in general without limit. You just have to disclose it.
Let me ask you, what is the state's position on the $500 aggregate contribution limit after McCutcheon?
As to what it applies to?
Is it constitutional or unconstitutional?
The
aggregate.
So the state's position is completely constitutional, and it's constitutional for a couple of different reasons. The first is that it's not a $500 aggregate limit in any relevant, in any constitutionally relevant sense. It's a $500 limit as in the 60-day organizational window for any particular committee. Just no contributions or expenditures in excess of $500. Of course, after the 60 days expires, there is no limit at all. So it's not an aggregate limit in any relevant, not certainly not in the way that the Supreme Court of the United States has described aggregate limits. It's not a limit in the Citizens United sense. It's not a limit in the McCutcheon sense. It's not a limit in the Buckley versus Vallejo sense.
Because it expires?
Well, for two reasons, I guess. One is because it expires after 60 days. But the second is that even in the 60 days, it's not a limit. Because if you want to speak, you can speak by just filing a form with the Texas Ethics Commission to say, hey, I want to speak.
Okay.
So it doesn't limit anyone ever.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your
Honor. All right. Mr. Najjar, you saved 5 minutes.
Okay, I think maybe the best way to highlight the weakness in the state's case is that they want this court, the argument is you can uphold a 2-month prior restraint on speech on a new group that's formed to be active in politics because they can speak through nonprofits and through specific purpose committees. Nonprofits don't file campaign finance reports. They don't report contributions. You don't know where the money comes from. Specific purpose committees do not file special pre-election reports in the last 9 days before an election unless the local jurisdiction requires them, because the election code does not require them. Why would the state be arguing that this is necessary for disclosure, but assert that we should have just that my client should have just spoken through a nonprofit or through a specific purpose committee? It doesn't make any sense. Aside from that, the nonprofits are totally irrelevant. Not every new general purpose committee has a related nonprofit. This is a facial challenge. The nonprofits at issue in this, related to two of the plaintiffs, are not even relevant to the facial challenge. And one of the plaintiffs, Texas Freedom Pact, does not have a related nonprofit. To address the standing argument, and then I'll return to the other issues a little later, but Wilson versus Bernberg, all the court needs to do is read that opinion and you will immediately see why it does not change the longstanding application of this mootness exception in election cases. As they admitted, Wilson versus Bernberg involved the court found that literally the court's opinion states that that dispute was generated by personal animus from the chairman of the party at issue there and the candidate who was trying to get on the ballot. And the reason that they held that it was moot was because that dispute was not likely to occur again. In this case, and Carmouche and Moore versus Hoseman say this directly. When the statute is going to apply to additional individuals in the future and prevent, in this case, political speech, in those cases, it's ballot access issues, which are even less protected in the First Amendment, the state has more discretion. When those statutes remain, the dispute remains live, and the court hears the case. The standing remains. Because they spent so much time on this corporate speech issue, I want to address it a little further. First, it's quite something to hear the Ethics Commission come here and almost willfully misrepresent the application of the political committee definition. It does not matter if you have an already existing nonprofit. In order to raise funds for political purposes, which my clients have said it's in the brief. I cited the deposition testimony. They didn't have corporate war chests in their nonprofits to spend on election speech. The plan was they had to go and raise money for these purposes. That makes them a general purpose committee. If you look at advisory opinion number 242 from the Ethics Commission, it's cited in my reply brief. It makes very clear, even where there's an existing nonprofit, if you're going to act in concert and pool resources for political speech, you are a political committee. And if you're depending on your purpose for acting, if you're bound together by common principles, You're a general purpose committee. There is no way to escape the effect of that definition, despite the state's...
Wouldn't that depend on the nature of the nonprofit? Couldn't you slip over into the specific side?
They cannot. They absolutely cannot. And this is in... I've quoted the language from the campaign guide from the commission itself on page 23 of my brief, where they say specifically that if a candidate would lose the committee's support if its position on an issue changed, then that committee is a general purpose committee. It illustrates general purpose committees are committees bound together by principles. They're not bound to a specific candidate through familial relations or. It's his buddy and they want to get this person elected. It's committee. If you're motivated by principles and not individuals and identified candidates, you are a general purpose committee. And if the court reads the two definitions of general and specific purpose committees, that comes through as well, because it specifically says a general purpose committee does not become a specific purpose committee by choosing a candidate to support, and vice versa. And the definition of specific purpose committee specifically says a specific purpose committee cannot have the aims of a general purpose committee. If my clients were deposed as they were, and if you just read the pleadings, the verified complaint here, it's very clear these plaintiffs are motivated by principles, not specific candidates. They vet the candidates and choose the ones they want to support. So that's a specious argument. And again, even if they could file as SPACs, SPACs are subject to their own 30-day prior restraint. That's also cited in my brief, and my time is up.
All right. Thank you, sir.